products, all for free. Visit RamseyRecycles.com/EC. To learn more and get directions, that's RamseyRecycles.com/EC.
Are you listening to Fresh Air Community Radio? KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis or online at kfai.org. Well, so am I.
Me too.
Good afternoon and welcome to Mini Culture Presents. Thank you for being a KFAI listener and for joining me here today. Hope you're having a lovely Memorial Day. Today on Mini Culture Presents, we are pleased to present episodes 5 and 6 of the Mini Culture podcast from producers John Gwynn and Julie Sensulo from season 10. If you haven't caught the first few episodes of what we've been airing in previous weeks, no worries. You can catch up on all of them in your podcast feed if you subscribe to the Mini Culture Podcast, where you enjoy listening to your podcasts. This is season 10, and if you haven't already heard them, there are another 9 great seasons out there for you to enjoy. Some great Minnesota-centric stories waiting for you to discover there. You can also find it all at their SoundCloud page, soundcloud.com/miniculture. Plus, new episodes of season 10 are continuing to drop, so keep an eye on your podcast feed for those. And of course, you can always find them at kfai.org under the Mini Culture tab. And now, on with the show.
Welcome to the Mini Culture Podcast. I'm your host, Erica Janik. The film Harold and Maude is generally revered as a cult classic, but it wasn't destined to be. In fact, it originally bombed at the box office. The film probably would have never made its way into popular culture until one theater in Minneapolis decided to book it. Julie Sensulo tells the story of how a neighborhood theater put this almost forgotten film on the map.
John Gaspard was in 9th grade in 1971. When he transferred to Anthony Junior High in South Minneapolis, which went about as well as it could when you transfer schools as a teenager.
I was thrown into public junior high where I didn't really know anybody.
John didn't have a lot of friends at his new school, but he started to connect with people over one of his favorite hobbies.
One of the things I enjoyed doing was goofing around with my Super 8 film camera that my uncle had given me, doing animations of G.I. Joes fighting each other and that sort of thing. And there were other kids in the school who were interested in that sort of thing as well. So we sort of, that's how we met each other.
In March of 1972, some of John's new film friends told him about a movie that was playing at the Westgate Theater on the corner of 45th and France Avenue in Minneapolis. According to these friends, John had to see this movie.
So I got on my bike on one Saturday night and rode from my house to the Westgate Theater, which is only a couple miles away, and locked the bike and went in for the 7:30 show of Harold and Maude.
John didn't know much about this film, Harold and Maude, when he went into the theater, only that it was supposed to be kind of dark and quirky. And that's about all he knew coming out of the theater, too.
Because the audience's reaction with laughter was so much, it was probably a full house, that I felt like I'd missed half the movie. So I came back the next day to see it again.
John would continue to go back and watch Harold and Maude at the Westgate again and again and again for over 2 years. Because the Westgate Theater continued to play it. In fact, the only film the Westgate played for 115 weeks was Harold and Maude. And this two-year run at a small neighborhood theater is probably the only reason you've heard of this film. Because this run is what turned an unpopular flop of a movie into a cult classic. Harold and Maude, in case you haven't seen it, is a story about a relationship between the angsty 19-year-old Harold, played by Bud Cort, and the free-spirited 79-year-old Maude, played by Ruth Gordon. Both Harold and Maude have a bit of an obsession with death. Harold, in particular, performs theatrical suicide attempts in front of his mother.
I suppose you think that's very funny, Harold.
The film opens with Harold pretending to hang himself and his mother entering the room and saying,
"Oh, dinner at 8, Harold. And do try and be a little more vivacious."
Maude and Harold, fittingly, meet at a funeral, but not the funeral of a mutual friend. They both just like to go to funerals for fun.
"I heard he's 80 years old. I'll be 80 next week. Good time to move on, don't you think?"
The two strike up a friendship that ultimately leads to romance.
"I like you, Mom."
"I like you, Harold."
A May-December romance with lots of fake suicide attempts, it's honestly a hard premise to sell, which is probably why it didn't sell. The film absolutely bombed its opening weekend in December of 1971. Here's John Gaspard again.
Paramount released it with a very bad marketing campaign. They didn't know how to do ads for it. They didn't know how to do a trailer for it. They didn't know what to do with it.
Nothing illustrates this more than the movie's original poster. A plain white rectangle with the words Harold and Maude written in a neutral sans serif font in the center. The word Harold is in purple and Maude is in pink. It literally feels like a marketing executive throwing up their hands in defeat. But Paramount, the studio that produced the film, needed something.
It was Christmas 1971, and Paramount Pictures owed a bunch of theaters a movie called The Godfather.
"It's too late. They start shooting in a week.
I'm going to make them an offer he can't refuse."
They had booked The Godfather in big theaters all across the country, and The Godfather wasn't done.
With nothing else to offer for the Christmas season, the studio suggested that theaters program another one of Paramount's upcoming films.
And so Paramount said to the theaters, "Here, take this other movie, Harold and Maude. It stars Academy Award winner Ruth Gordon, and you'll like this as much as The Godfather."
I love that they thought, if you were looking for The Godfather, you'll love Harold and Maude.
Yeah, it's analogous. So it died.
The film died in Hollywood when it opened, and it died right here in the Midwest.
In Minneapolis, where it played, downtown at the World Theater, it lasted for 2 weeks and then disappeared.
Despite poor marketing, some local critics actually really enjoyed Harold and Maude, which is why the Westgate Theater still decided to book a run of the film in the spring of 1972. The Westgate had a reputation for playing interesting, edgier films that you couldn't necessarily see at larger theaters. It always had, ever since it opened in 1935 by a man named Carl Fuss.
He was a very accomplished musician and world class, actually.
This is Nancy Saslow.
I am the granddaughter of Carl Fust, who opened the Westgate Theater.
Nancy never met her grandfather, but she grew up hearing stories of him playing violin in the Minnesota Orchestra. Carl's first love was music, and so when he built the Westgate, he installed a stage under the screen, imagining it as a true mixed-media venue.
And that was his vision, I think, was to bring music and theater to the neighborhood.
The Westgate struggled in its early years to make a name for itself. It was only a few blocks away from another popular neighborhood theater, the Edina.
He wasn't daunted by that. He thought, well, there's plenty of movies, you know, to go around. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case. He actually got very little of the first run movies. So that was a disappointment for him.
Carl still dreamed of booking popular first run films at the Westgate. But 2 years after the theater opened, Carl Fust was in a car accident and he died at the age of 47.
So very young and didn't see the dream of his successful theater ever realized.
After Carl's death, the Westgate changed ownership several times. The new owners also struggled to compete with the Edina Theater, so they tried carving out a new niche for the theater by booking offbeat and strange films. This reputation is what kept the Westgate afloat, although it wasn't exactly what attracted assistant manager Randy Green to the job.
Basically, I liked movie theaters. Not so much the movies themselves, though I love movies too. The idea of running one, the fun of watching people enjoy what you got on the screen and getting people in and out, and that fascinated me.
Randy was working as the assistant manager when Harold and Maude first opened at the Westgate.
Do you remember the first night that it played?
Yeah, it played on a Wednesday night when it opened up. I didn't work that night, but I went in Thursday the next day, and the staff was going, "It was nuts last night. You should have been here. It was just crazy."
The fact that Harold and Maude had a strong opening night at the Westgate was unusual, considering most theaters had struggled to attract audiences. But the Westgate had something that other theaters didn't have, and that was Deduva.
Deduva. Deduva. At Zeman so far away in the...
Deduva was a short film that the Westgate had booked to open before Harold and Maude. Deduva is funny, it's absurd, it features Madeline Kahn in her first on-screen role, and it takes place in an entirely fictional language that you slowly realize is just a vaguely Swedish version of English.
Yeah, yeah. Olden people's been feeling me presents, girl. Sooner or late, girl.
But it's your wanting.
The Westgate figured Deduva and Harold and Maude were both a little weird. And so they programmed the two together. This pairing was a big deal, at least to one local film critic.
There was a critic in town named Will Jones. And Will Jones wrote for the Tribune. And he wrote a column that said, "You've got to go see this movie, Deduva. You've got to go see it."
Will Jones published this article on a Monday.
The film opened on Wednesday and was nearly sold out, and sold out Thursday and Friday and Saturday.
Audiences came in droves to see Deduva, but it didn't take long for them to be equally as charmed by the film that played after it. Night after night, weekend after weekend, people kept coming back to watch the relationship between Maude and Harold flourish. Loyal viewers would bring their friends, and then their friends would bring other friends.
I know for some people it was a litmus test where they would take a date to it. And if the date didn't like it, they go, "All right, I know everything I need to know about you."
Nancy Saslow saw Harold and Maude for the first time at the theater that her grandfather founded. She says she remembers the film as optimistic, despite Harold's fixation on suicide.
And I think because of, you know, the era that the 70s were, you know, people were looking for hope. And it kind of gave people a sense of fun and joy and hope, you know, that anything's possible.
John liked going to see Harold and Maude as often as possible because it gave him a chance to study it.
It was a filmmaking class in and of itself.
The film's director, Hal Ashby, got his start in film as an editor, and his editing skills are on full display in Harold and Maude.
Watching what he did, you learned, oh, that's what a hard cut can do. That has an impact. Oh, that's how you do a montage. It isn't just a collection of shots. It's a collection of shots that are building to something. I was very lucky that I could go and see it again and again.
One fan in particular, a young man named Doug Strand, saw the film an estimated 212 times during the Westgate's run, although several of those viewings happened at the Grandview Theater in St. Paul, which also programmed Harold and Maude after the Westgate had such great success.
When I find something I like, I stick with it.
This is Doug.
And that's probably part of my personality that led me to go to the movie 212 times.
Doug admits that he is someone who likes to do things over and over. When he saw The Sound of Music in high school, he went to see it 7 more times, even though he had to drive 40 miles to the theater each time. He also likes to hold on to gifts that people give him. He's sentimental like that. But for Doug, Harold and Maude represented something else.
My parents were really old when I was born, so I got used to being around older people. It didn't seem odd to me at all. I went to my first senior citizen meeting when I was probably 10.
Did you think you saw yourself in this film in a way that you hadn't before?
I did. I could relate to Harold, not with all of the suicides, but I guess subliminally I did want some kind of attention. I didn't have a lot. I was sort of a free-range child when I was growing up.
As a young person who was more comfortable with older adults than his own peers, Doug felt seen by this film, just like Harold feels seen by Maude, which, as John Gaspard points out, is what the film is all about.
Although it suggests a sexuality, that's not what it's about at all. It's about her seeing him. He'd never been seen before. And she sees him and she completely accepts him. And that's what it's about. It's about being seen and being accepted and then learning to go and keep doing that. It's not about the suicides and it's not about sex with a 79-year-old woman. It's about helping someone grow and become a person.
Viewers like Doug and John adored Harold and Maude and the experience of seeing it over and over at the Westgate. But it wasn't the love from the community that kept the film running for 2 years.
What do you know about the owners of the Westgate's thinking? Do they love the film? Do they believe in it? What's going on with their thinking here?
You're giving them a whole lot more heart than they actually have. The only reason it stayed for 115 weeks was it was making more money than putting something new in there. That was the only reason. People will say, oh, no, they loved it. It's like, I don't think they cared. They were a little mystified by it, but it was strictly financial.
People kept buying tickets, and so the Westgate kept renewing it. At a certain point, the physical reels started to wear out, and so the Westgate had to order more. Here's Randy Green, the assistant manager of the theater again.
All those screenings takes its toll on a film print. Scratched, you have film breaks, you have splices and stuff. We would ask for new prints, and they'd send us new prints, and finally they ran out of new prints. At one point, they said, tell you what we'll do. We'll send you 3 or 4 prints. You take the best 5 reels out of those 5, the reels we copy we send you, and then you can use those instead. So that's what they did. They picked the 5 best ones and used that.
Randy and the other employees at the theater would piece together sections from different prints of the movie to make one full-length film.
So by the end of it, they were like, had really just, the community was literally holding this film together. Yeah. The Westgate was holding it together in so, like, literally and figuratively.
Yeah, really, yeah.
After Harold and Maude had run at the Westgate for a year, other theaters started to take note, both locally and beyond. The fandom of the Westgate gave national theaters something they didn't have when the film first came out, and that was an effective marketing strategy. The Detroit Free Press, for example, published an ad for Harold and Maude that read, "As Minneapolis goes, so goes the nation." A theater in New York ran ads asking, "What do they know in the Midwest that we don't know in New York?" The run at the Westgate also caught the attention of the film's leading actors. For the 2-year anniversary of Harold and Maude at the Westgate, the film stars Ruth Gordon and Bud Cort came to Minneapolis to witness the fandom that had formed around their almost forgotten film. John, a budding filmmaker, captured the 2-year anniversary on his Super 8 camera.
Miss Gordon, certainly a fan of yours, to say the least.
In this clip, a fan presents Ruth and Bud with some inscribed medallions.
So say, thank you, Ruth Gordon, and there's one similar for Mr. Court, for making Harold and Maude a classic.
Oh, how beautiful. Well, it'll go right with my other charms. And thank you so much.
Also a note card.
That's very thoughtful. Thank you.
Bud Court, who was still a young actor at the time, seemed completely dazzled by the whole experience, according to John. Here's Bud speaking to the sold-out crowd on the Westgate stage.
There's nothing anybody can say except thank you all for believing in the film and making this probably one of the most touching moments of my life, and I'm sure for Ruth, she said it.
I'm glad to be here.
This is Ruth Gordon speaking from the same stage.
It's a great thing to be a place where something goes right. And for 2 years at the Westgate Theater, things have gone right for Harold and Maude. And tonight, it includes Bud and me.
For 2 years inside the Westgate Theater, everything went right for Harold and Maude. But things could only go right for so long. A few weeks after Ruth and Bud visited Minneapolis, ticket sales finally started to wane. The excitement had reached its peak. On top of that, neighbors had started to complain that their local one-screen theater wasn't playing anything new. And so, after 1,956 screenings, the Westgate played its 1,957th and final screening of Harold and Maude. But by this point, national audiences had grown to love the film too. Theaters all around the country continued to program and reprogram screenings. The run at the Westgate was over, but the film's legacy was just beginning. The Westgate Theater no longer exists. The one-screen theater was no match for the rise of the multiplex. It closed in 1977, only a few years after the run of Harold and Maude ended. For former assistant manager Randy Green, the closing of the theater was sad, but the demolition of the Art Deco building hit him even harder.
I hate driving by the place, especially when it was still there. The marquee was gone. You could see the outline of the building and everything, but I felt sad going by the place. I don't drive by now at all, hardly, if I can help it.
Randy, ever the theater lover, now volunteers at the Heights Theater in North Minneapolis. Last November, Randy and John Gaspard teamed up to screen Harold and Maude along with the Duva at the Heights.
Welcome and good evening to the Heights Theater. My name is Randy Green. I help out here at the Heights. I probably tore your ticket tonight. Thank you very much.
Before the film started, Randy and John addressed the crowd.
Who saw Harold and Maude first at a movie theater? Any movie theater? Now here's a big question. Who saw Harold and Maude first at the Westgate?
At least 20 hands go up.
Wow. And the reason you are here is because of the Westgate Theater. No one here would be here tonight if it hadn't been for the Westgate.
The crowd at the Heights was a mix of all ages. Some people were there seeing the film for the first time. It was my first time seeing the film in a theater. Sitting with a cheering crowd at the Heights, I could imagine what it must have felt like at the Westgate 50 years ago. What it must have felt like to be a part of a community that loved a piece of art that others had tossed aside. What it must have felt like to see yourself in this film and to feel like the film saw you back. John Gaspard, who was an amateur filmmaker when Harold and Maude first came out, grew up to work in production. But these days, he's focusing more on writing. Last year, he released a book called Held Over, Harold and Maude at the Westgate Theater. Here he is talking about Held Over at the screening at the Heights.
The question I'm asked the most is, why did you write this silly book? And the reason is, there are other books about Harold and Maude. There's a very good one on the making of Harold and Maude by a guy named James Davidson. But he wasn't here from 72 to 74, and I was. And I was there maybe weekly. I don't know. I was there a lot.
John isn't a historian. He's just someone who was there. And sometimes just being there a lot is all a piece of art needs to survive. When John started writing Held Over, he had no grand aspirations of reaching a wide audience.
When I started doing it, I said to my wife, I think there's only three people who want to read it. I know I want to read it. It's primarily for me. The guy who was the assistant manager at the Westgate, I know he wants to read it.
That's Randy Green.
And the granddaughter of Carl Fust, who founded the theater.
That's Nancy Saslow.
So I thought, well, I will just do the best book I can for the three of us and hope that other people like it.
Just like Harold and Maude found its home at the Westgate, John's book has found a home with people who remember this strange little period in which a small community theater completely fell in love with a film that no one else seemed to want, and how that love changed the trajectory of that film forever.
Particularly now in the age of AI, if you write something that is from your heart for yourself, you're going to find there are other people out there. If you're trying to please them, it's never going to happen. If you write something to please yourself, you're bound to find an audience for it.
You've been listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Support for Miniculture is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Miniculture tab on kfai.org.
You are listening to Miniculture Presents here on KFEI. We are taking a momentary break from broadcasting two episodes of the brand spanking new Hot Off the Press Miniculture Podcast Season 10. We will return right after these short messages.
Support for KFAI comes from the Hook and Ladder Theater and Lounge, presenting Turtle Island Voices Rising, an indigenous hip-hop, R&B, and spoken word showcase, Friday, May 29th. Featuring Jada Brown, Thomas X, Isabella Lopez, Tiklu and Mishomas, Day Days, DJ AO, and DJ Maracoya. A celebration to close out Minnesota American Indian Month, displaying talents within the Native American indigenous community. Performances will be recorded as part of KFAI's Live from Minnesota series, made possible by the state of Minnesota and the Arts and Cultural Heritage Legacy Amendment. More information about Turtle Island Voices Rising at Hook and Ladder is available at thehookmpls.com. Don't waste it, recycle it.
Every pop can, every cardboard box, every hot sauce bottle counts.
That random junk mail, tomorrow's cereal box.
That glass bottle, next month's pickle jar.
That pop can, back on the shelf in just 60 days.
Don't waste it, recycle it.
Because in Minneapolis, what goes around comes right back around.
What else should you recycle?
Search Minneapolis Recycling to learn more.
Support for KFAI comes from First Avenue, presenting Sun Little at the Turf Club Friday, June 12th. Sun Little returns to the Turf Club with his new album, City Folk, an album that sees the roots, blues, soul singer-songwriter integrate elements of country, rock, hip-hop, and R&B into his sound. Themes of family, history, and personal growth run throughout his latest offering. Opening the show is Tonina. More information about Sun Little at the Turf Club is available at first-avenue.com.
You are tuned in to Mini Culture Presents, KFAI Sound and Documentary Showcase program. Today we are airing two episodes from the 10th season of the Mini Culture Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the Mini Culture Podcast so you can enjoy all nine other fantastic seasons of arts, culture, and history, stories about our great state, and catch new episodes as they become available. Support for this program comes from KFAI listener members just like yourself. So if you're able to help KFAI out financially, please do lend a hand. You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul, Radio Without Boundaries. Support for Mini Culture is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. We now continue with the Mini Culture Podcast.
Welcome to the Mini Culture Podcast. I'm your host, Erica Janik. The White Earth Reservation in northwestern Minnesota was created through a treaty with the federal government in 1867. The reservation was meant to be a space where the Anishinaabe people could be protected from white settlement. But within 50 years, timber companies had moved in and stripped the land bare. Producer John Gwynn brings us the story.
2026 marks the 40th anniversary of the White Earth Land Settlement Act. In this legislation from 1986, the federal and Minnesota government paid $17 million to the White Earth Ojibwe Nation, who claims their land had been taken illegally. These fraudulent transactions were initiated by the government and many lumber companies operating in Minnesota in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. These lumber companies, the so-called Pine Cartel, took possession of allotments from White Earth families. Then they cut and sold thousands of acres of the valuable white pine that covered these lands. For decades, the White Earth people had fought to get their land back. In the 1980s, after White Earth activists filed lawsuits in federal court to settle the title disputes, U.S. Representative Arlen Stangeland of Moorhead famously stated, "The Indians will get their land back when hell freezes over." The Anishinaabe, also called Ojibwe or Chippewa, have lived in the Great Lakes region for thousands of years, leading a traditional life in balance with nature and the seasons. Trees such as white pine or jingwak in the Ojibwe language were treated as relatives that offered many gifts. When European settlers came in the 19th century, the federal government began making treaties with the Anishinaabe to clear the way for white settlement. In 1867, a treaty created the White Earth Reservation in northwest Minnesota. It is a square piece of land consisting of over 1,300 square miles. State officials tried convincing indigenous people from all over Minnesota to settle in White Earth, supposedly to be protected from European settlement. Winona LaDuke, a White Earth native and longtime activist, shares what led up to the signing of the treaty.
Aneen, my name is Winona LaDuke, Benesique, Indigenikas, Makwendodiam, Gababani Ka, Gishkanaganing, and Dunjaba. I'm from the White Earth Reservation. In Dunjaba, Oma'a King, I'm from this land here. And I also am a curator at the Giwe Nong Museum in what is known as Park Rapids, Minnesota. And so these Anishinaabe people are trying to survive in the wake of increasing pressure on our territory. And at the same time, the Anishinaabe leaders were looking at the broader landscape, because what they had thought was that, you know, some folks would be coming. Not that some folks would be coming and staying. And so our leaders tried to do the best they could to negotiate treaties that would protect land, reserve rights, is what they say, like reserve our rights to harvest. When the Dakota were massacred in mass at the White Stone Massacre on September 3rd, 1863, in what is today known as North Dakota, 400 people were killed for no reason except for they were buffalo hunting, and they burned 1 million pounds of buffalo meat, effectively starving the Dakota Nation. The Ojibwe were not far away, and so we observed what was happening. We observed with great terror and grief what was happening to our Dakota relatives. And so in 1867, our great chiefs said, you know, we will sign a new treaty and we will make the White Earth Reservation. The 1867 treaty, which guaranteed 36 townships of land, was a treaty where we thought as Anishinaabe, we could be protected. The chiefs that signed the 1867 treaty, including Mejikagijik and Wabanaquat and Bad Boy, they looked upon the lands of the North and they selected what they considered to be the best land for the Anishinaabe. The White Earth Reservation, 837,000 acres of land, is comprised of three biomes: the white pines of the east, the maple hardwood forests of the center, and the prairie of the west. And explicit in the 1867 treaty, Article 7, it says the lands so held by any Indian shall be exempt from taxation and sale for debt, and shall not be alienated except with the approval of the Secretary of Interior, and in no case to any person not a member of the Chippewa. The intention was is that White Earth would be retained by our people. And they moved there, you know, with the promise that the land would be good. The lakes were plentiful, 47 lakes, 500 bodies of water. You can fish on every lake, wild rice in great abundance. Offer them a oxen, a school, a hospital, a farrier, and it'll all be good. And they will be civilized. But it didn't work out that way. So a rich land. And in that wealth of that rich land, our people were able to feed themselves and, you know, flourish again. But that was not to last long. That was not to last long because greed, the immense greed of America, the immense greed of Minnesota, the immense greed of the white, you know, entrepreneurs was unabated and unchecked.
Despite the promises of protection from the white encroachment, timber companies eyed the land at White Earth with great interest. After cutting through the St. Croix River Valley, they turned toward the North Woods. Men like Thomas Shevlin, Frederick Weyerhaeuser, T.B. Walker, Albert Carpenter, Sumner McKnight, and many others began scheming with legislators to take ownership of the lands designated for the Anishinaabe stated in the Treaty of 1867.
But it turns out that those beautiful white pine forests that were much of northern Minnesota at first sort of settlement were also very important for the logging industry.
This is Angela Gupta, a forester with the University of Minnesota Extension.
And so when Minnesota was first getting settled, it was very common that the logging industry would come into those white pine stands. They were actually considered inexhaustible. So there was no end to the resource and they could never overharvest it. And that turned out that was incorrect.
To seize more land for white settlement and force the assimilation of Native people, Congress passed the General Allotment Act in 1887. This act, also known as the Dawes Act, authorized the breaking up of all the reservations, land that was communally held by the tribes, into individual plots of 80 acres. This act completely changed the provisions of the treaties that the government had itself written. And according to the United States Constitution, treaties are to be upheld as the supreme law of the land. Minnesota also passed its own laws that sped up the transfer of native land to non-native people, such as timber companies.
So the idea was to give people 80-acre parcels, and then whatever was surplus, then that would be open for white settlement. And that's how a good portion of, you know, 3/4 of all reservation land was lost nationally through the General Allotment Act. And White Earth, you know, in the end, 90% of our land was taken. Canute Nelson, who was a senator, in 1889, got the Nelson Act passed. And for the next 20 years, 99% of the land was illegally taken from the Anishinaabe and peddled, one of the most destructive pieces of legislation.
The Nelson Act legalized the sale of any land deemed surplus to non-natives, violating the terms of the treaty. Lumber companies quickly took advantage. Marcy Rendon is an author and a White Earth descendant.
And that was how Clearwater County was all timber. The timber companies went in, clear-cut everything, and then once they had all the timber, they just abandoned it. And abandoned land then became property of the state. So that's how Clearwater County isn't a part of the White Earth Reservation.
But the government wasn't done. In 1904, Moses Clapp, a legislator from Fergus Falls, put forth an act that authorized all Chippewa of Minnesota to sell the timber on their allotments. Congressman Halvor Stenersen of Crookston wrote a companion law that gave White Earth Anishinaabe an additional 80 acres of land. Taken together, these acts legalized the sale of timber and supplied extra land for that timber to be taken from.
So, within 3 weeks of the passage of the Clapp Act, 250 mortgages against reservation lands were recorded. And land hustlers and land companies worked hand in hand. By 1910, 3/4 of the allotments had been sold, and logging was rapidly destroying the White Earth pine forest. One of the interesting things about the Moses Clapp bill was that they made a special provision for mixed bloods to sell land. And, you know, Anishinaabe people didn't really have like a full blood, mixed blood thing because we were intermarried with the Dakota. So, you know, the idea of a mixed blood, which is, you know, entrenched in the racism of the United States, creation of blood quantum, is one of the mechanisms they use to steal our land. So within a very short period of time, most of the land on White Earth ended up in non-native hands. You know, we were decimated by the theft of our land and then the theft of our trees, just leaving people living basically in refugee camps.
In 1908, as the land theft and timber continued, the federal government sent investigators to White Earth.
Before their investigation was cut short, they reported fully 90% of these full bloods have sold their land and they've been swindled and defrauded by every scheme possible. Fully 60% are suffering from tuberculosis in its various forms. 30 to 35% are afflicted with trachoma and eye disease, making many totally blind. I doubt if a worse condition exists on any reservation in the United States.
This investigation led to the filing of more than 1,000 lawsuits documenting the widespread evidence of fraud that occurred in the taking of tribal lands.
The Pine Cartel, a group that had shown itself to be unconcerned about the rules, gathered together in Detroit Lakes to come up with a plan. They convinced the federal government to authorize one of their own attorneys, Ransom Powell of Mankato, to determine the blood status of all White Earth enrollees.
And so in 1913, Congress authorized Ransom Powell of the U.S. Justice Department to make up a new blood roll of the White Earth Anishinaabe, listing people as either full or mixed bloods, and legally racializing the Anishinaabe into a non-Ojibwe blood category. he sent two anthropologists, physical anthropologists to White Earth to figure out who was a full blood and who was a mixed blood. Alice Herlishka, known as the bone doctor from the Smithsonian, who conducted horrific, horrific studies around the world. He came to White Earth with Albert Jenks from the University of Minnesota, and they examined 696 people from the reservation. And how they would do that is that they set up these little tents. They had some BS idea that if you measure people's heads, you scratch their skin, including on their, on their chest, and you look at their hair, and you measure across their forehead, you know, that you will be able to determine who's a full blood and a mixed blood. And so in their made up medical anthropology, they had full brothers and sisters as being, some were mixed blood and some was full blood. That is how they stole our land, because it was possible to sell your land if you were a mixed blood. And so in that process, much of our reservation was taken illegally.
Timber taken from these lands came to decorate upper class homes in the Midwest and beyond. Advertisements from the 1920s touted the beauty and good taste of Shevlin pine paneling. The lumber barons made a fortune off the sale of this pine, while the destitute, diseased, and disenfranchised people of White Earth struggled to survive.
I've always heard it said, some get rich and some get poor. And that's how that happens. And so, like, many times I've, like, wandered in downtown, like, fancy areas of Minneapolis, and I was like, oh, we built that. We built that. You know, because that's all our wood that built these great mansions here. That came from our reservation, you know. And the impact on our community was devastating because we lost everything. You know, when we were literally looking at stumps, when we had been looking at forests. We filed many, many legal cases in the court system, but to have justice in the court system in 1904, 1910, 1915, as an Indian person, you had zero chance of justice. You know, so there was many, many legal claims about the illegal takings of the timber, the illegal takings of land. You know, many were filed from White Earth and from other reservations, but we did not receive any justice. You know, I can feel the genetic memory of the trauma, you know, which occurred to my, you know, my community, my people. The Anishinaabe people suffered a lot, you know, from all of this stealing, theft, violence, which occurred on the land and the people.
For decades, tribal members fought for the return of their land. In the 1970s, federal investigators once again came in to review tribal claims of stolen land. Meetings were held, tribal members spoke at state and federal hearings, years passed, and then in 1986, state, county, and tribal officials came to an agreement. The White Earth Land Settlement Act gave the Reservation Business Council $17 million in exchange for the clearance of all land title disputes. The tribe was also promised the return of 10,000 acres of land. Many tribal members opposed the act. They wanted to keep fighting to take back all of the stolen land of White Earth. The lawsuits were dismissed, so Winona LaDuke and other activists launched the White Earth Land Recovery Project in 1989. Since its founding, they brought back over 1,000 acres of land. In 2024, State Senator Mary Kunish introduced legislation to return management of the White Earth State Forest back to the tribe. Kunish is the first American Indian woman to serve in the Minnesota state legislature. But due to fierce opposition from some state residents, it didn't pass. Kunish, however, sees this as a learning moment for everyone in Minnesota.
I think the most important thing that people can do these days is to educate themselves on the history of the treaties in Minnesota and treaties across the country. Understanding the historic process of these lands being taken from the tribes, and then trying to reconcile that with how they can be good partners and good neighbors with the tribes in saying, let's work this out in a way that's a win for all of us, because we're neighbors, like I said. You know, our families have been here for generations, yours have been here for hundreds of thousands of years, but how do we live together in a really good way and honor each other?
On February 3rd, 2026, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources and the White Earth Nation came to an agreement on natural resource management in the White Earth State Forest. White Earth Nation Tribal Chairman Michael Fairbanks commented that the agreement represents a critical step towards restoring tribal, cultural, and historical environmental values. For Mini Culture, I'm Deanna Standing Cloud.
This story was reported and produced by John Gwynn and narrated by Deanna Standing Cloud. You've been listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. Support for Mini Culture is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Mini Culture tab on kfai.org.
You are listening to Mini Culture Presents here on KFEI. My name is Michael Whetstone, and that was episode 6 of the 10th season of the award-winning Mini Culture Podcast. Check your podcast feeds for more episodes to come. If you don't already subscribe to the Mini Culture Podcast, you really should. Also, I'll drop a plug for the previous 9 seasons. You've got some enjoyable catching up to do. Plus, you can stay on top of everything else these talented producers are doing at Miniculture's SoundCloud page, soundcloud.com/miniculture. At that SoundCloud page, you can easily share them with your friends from there too. And if you would like to help keep these very vital and hyper-local Minnesota-centric stories on the air, consider making a pledge today to Miniculture's Radio Home. KFEI relies on your financial support. Real community. Truly people-powered public radio. Please make a difference and a donation today at kfei.org. Thank you. You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFEI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Radio Without Boundaries. Support for this program comes from KFEI listener members, just like you. Support for Mini Culture is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. And I believe we do have time for one more recent story from Mini Culture right now. And thanks again for tuning in. Then stick around for the Upside Down.
This is 10,000 Fresh Voices, a program of Mini Culture on KFAI. Did you know that there are more than 300 public library branches in Minnesota? It takes a lot of people power to keep things running smoothly. Many of these libraries are supported by avid book lovers who volunteer as part of their library's friends group. KFAI producer R. May Rivard caught up with a group of retirees in Brainerd dedicated to the support of their local library.
Nearly every library I've been to has a book sale or two during the year. The proceeds from these sales help support all kinds of things at the library. I'm fairly certain these sales are staffed and run by people who love books, and these volunteers are the worker bees behind every successful sale. As a person who loves to read and support my favorite libraries by perusing any sale I find out about, I was curious about how all this worked. Well, I got a peek behind the curtain with the Friends of the Brainerd Public Library as they sorted and sniffed their way through loads of donated books in the receiving area behind the storefront located in the Westgate Mall up in Brainerd. Meet Judy Reardon.
I live in rural Brainerd. I became involved with Friends of the Brainerd Public Library probably 25 years ago. One of the gals that I worked with volunteered with them, and it sounded interesting. So I began volunteering at their sales.
I had recently retired, and I wanted to do something with my time. I don't like to sew like I used to do. I don't know how to crochet, knit. So I just decided my love is reading books. I got involved, joined a book club with the Friends, and then found out about this book sale.
That's Karen Johnson, the current president of the Friends of the Brainerd Public Library.
My name is Mary Kalinowski, and I live in the Brainerd-Baxter area. I've been up here about 45 years. I'm a retired RN, work mostly in the clinics, and I've been retired for about 10 years. So working as a friend of the Brainerd Public Library is one of my volunteer jobs and the one that I like more than anything else that I do.
This is a group of people that gather every single Tuesday, and we sort through the books. And there are a ton of books that we get that are donated primarily by community members.
My task is when the books come in, we open each box at a time and check the books over. So every book gets handled at least once. We check the cover, make sure it's in good condition. We sniff all our books. We're all good sniffers here. We want our books to smell good. We page through them, fan through them to make sure there's no leftover paperwork in the books that people use for bookmarks. So we occasionally find a letter or store receipts or bookmarks, that kind of thing. We have found money, and several hundred dollars once in cash, and we were able to track the source and give the gentleman his money back. We sort our books and put them in these tubs, and then we move the books from the tubs out into the main part of the store in the correct category.
Judy Reardon, and we would put the books out in preparation for the sale, and then during the sale we would take stacks of books from people and take them up to the checkout table so they wouldn't have to lug all those books around with them. We are located in the Westgate Mall. The mall has been extremely generous to us, giving us space for probably about 10 years. And for the last 5 or so years, we have been located in the same spot, which allowed us to set up as though we were having a book sale. And when we would sort the books, we would just put them out on the tables. And that has really been a lifesaver, saves a lot of time.
Sounds like a workout.
It is. Tuesday is our donation day. So we are here from 9 to 3, and they bring them to the service door of the store that we're located in at the Westgate Mall. About 97% of our books are donated from the public, and the other 3% are ones that the library has cleaned out. We have two pallets end-to-end in our service area in the back. It is not uncommon for those pallets to be empty on a Tuesday morning and be completely filled with boxes of books by the time we leave at 3 o'clock.
Most libraries have a Friends of fill in the blank public library that really do this. They walk alongside their library and say, how can we help you? What can we do? With that money that we raise, it all goes back into our library for what we call kind of the icing on the cake. We don't determine what we should buy. We look to the librarian, and our librarian looks to the staff and says, what do we need? The Friends group wants to donate. What can we use? So our overall goal is to truly support our library with whatever needs they have, and then also support that love of reading.
The dedication of these gals was impressive. It was more work than I would have ever thought went into sorting books. And now I know who to ask to recommend the next Minnesota author for me to read.
Thanks for listening. Support for Mini Culture on KFAI is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Mini Culture tab on kfai.org.
Thank you.
Imperial hexagram, unquiet carpenter, better be thankful, better be thankful, do sign.